Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When Betty White died in 2021, we were somehow surprised. Even at 99 years old, it felt like she was gone too soon. Smokey Robinson just released a new album. He's 83. Martha Stewart posed in a bathing suit on the cover of Sports Illustrated at 81. What is going on? Well, the way we think about aging is just much different than it used to be. And Ken Dykewald is one of the foremost authorities on changing perceptions. For more than 45 years, he's been an original thinker on the lifestyle, marketing, healthcare, economic, and workforce implications of this massive age wave in America. On today's episode, he tells us that older adults no longer have to put up with being called golden agers because they're too busy leading vibrant, productive lives beyond traditional retirement. This is all part of the growing unretirement trend across the country. Happy retirees don't necessarily stop working completely. They just start saying no to the things they've never liked in the first place and find themselves in a place of real financial independence. With a mindset of usefulness over youthfulness, Ken encourages older individuals to seek a balance between work and professional pursuits. It's like he read my mind. The great Ken Dykewald, coming up right here on the Retire Sooner podcast.
I'm Wes Moss. The prevailing thought in America is that you'll never have enough money and it's almost impossible to retire early. Actually, I think the opposite is true. For more than 20 years, I've been researching, studying, and advising American families, including those who started late, on how to retire sooner and happier. So my mission with the Retire Sooner podcast is to help a million people retire earlier while enjoying the adventure along the way. I'd love for you to be one of them. Let's get started.
Maybe we just start with a little bit of your thoughts over how aging has just radically changed. I mean, you started studying this again almost 50 years ago, and what it was with the study of aging then and how people, the mindset of America then versus today, and I would say 5 years ago, and then what is it like over the last 5 years, but really just bring me through that. How the field has changed and how we think so differently about aging today.
Sure. And first of all, it's an honor to be with you and it's great to be on your program. So thanks for having me. So I sort of by accident started working with older adults when I was 24 in 1974. So that's 49 years ago. Back then, if you were over the age of 60, you were old. And they used to call older people golden agers. And then somebody came along with the phrase, with the word seniors, and that kind of caught fire for a while, and now that's dying away. Most people who were older were happy to have made it that long because their parents probably didn't. If they lived past 60 or 65, they thought they had a few more years before their batteries wore out. It was a time, this is going to sound really bizarre, but during World War II, there was a wage freeze imposed on all employers. And so partly the way employers and unions got around that was that they created pensions. And that generation of older people back when I first got in the field, between being frugal, having grown up in the Depression, or in the shadow of the Depression, having pensions, and also very much not thinking they were going to live very long, there wasn't that much of a worry about financing a long retirement or even what retirement was supposed to be It was just kind of a tag on at the end of a working life. And then what I've seen over this half century is that up until about a year or so ago, there were more and more older people. They were living longer and longer and longer. People didn't have any clue what to do with that period of their lives. They realized that if they stopped working, they might have 10 or 20 or even 30 years in front of them because they had an uncle or an aunt or a grandpa who lived a long life, but clueless about who they could be and what they ought to do and how they might feel good about themselves. It was just sort of a new period of life. It was like a new frontier. Now, what's going on is that the subject has just exploded. And for me, I've watched over the decades as individuals or moments have happened that have kind of triggered changes. So when Betty White passed away, it was a massive amount of media attention because all of a sudden people said, I've never seen a 99-year-old before who was attractive and fun and good sense of timing and cared about people and cared about animals. And I'd like to be that kind of 99-year-old. And then all of a sudden, you know, Smokey Robinson drops a new album at 83. And the Stones are putting out a new album, first new album in 18 years. And Martha Stewart lands on the cover of Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. And Harrison Ford comes.
By the way, to me, I remember when I realized what her age is, I thought it was a typo. I could not believe, because Martha Stewart is in her 80s, right?
81.
She's 81. And I really, I don't know, I guess I, in my mind, back when she did, I don't know, 20 years ago, I think in my mind I was frozen at around 60. So when I saw her on the cover, she was on CNBC one the morning that the Sports Illustrated came out, and just I was thinking, oh, she's probably around 60. And to hear that she's in her 80s is remarkable, right? So these are amazing examples.
It's sort of like a new age of aging has started up. And it's not just one person or another. There's 250,000 people now competing in the Senior Olympics. There are, you know, millions of people who are reinventing themselves. There are community colleges that are popping up all over the place now for emeritus students, you know, people who want to go back to school at 50 or 60. And people are falling in love again at 70 if they've been widowed or divorced. And so what we're seeing is kind of a new frontier. And there are role models emerging. And I also last want to say that one of the big changes is that women are biologically superior to men. And so they live 5 to 6 years longer than men. And so we've got longevity for men, but then we've got a version of it for women. And it's different. It's longer. There's more money needed. There's more questioning about what am I going to do? Who am I going to be? How am I going to live? How am I going to steer clear of isolation and loneliness? And these topics have gotten very hot. You know, it's kind of fun to see a subject that when I first got into it, nobody wanted to talk about it. And now you can't pick up a newspaper or magazine or a news show without hearing new views about what it could be to be older and what kind of freedoms and what kinds of possibilities exist.
Well, I think part of it maybe, Ken, too, is it the thought that boomers are now, so many boomers are in retirement age, whereas is that part of it, is that we've got such a large part of the demographics that are really in the sweet spot of figuring out what to do with the next 20 and 30 years. Is that part of this?
Yeah, and I'd split it in three ways, if that's okay with you. First of all, the boomers are just a huge number of people. And so, you know, it used to be referred to as a pig going through a python. Now that the boomers are getting older, we're seeing a whole lot of attention focused on people getting older. Second, the boomers were quirky bunch. You know, they changed majors in college. They were more likely to change partners. If the relationship wasn't working out, they changed religions. They relocated. And so they're going into their later years with this idea that reinvention and change is okay. You know, what can I learn? And the third thing that's happening is that they pull the marketplace with them. So, man, oh, man, the number of ads you see now for financial services firms, help you save to and through retirement, vitamin companies, wellness companies, Sculptology companies. Yeah, it's just, it's almost unbelievable the amount of attention, whether it's travel and leisure, financial services, home renovation. The boomers are pulling the markets towards them as well.
Yeah, I always remember the thought around the boomers made hula hoops. Like when they were 7 and 10 years old, there was the blossoming of the hula hoop. So every demographic, or throughout the entire demographics of boomers, they've moved the market. To your point, they're pulling the market along with them. So here's one thing I've been studying pretty recently is this thought around un-retirement. And really just looking at economic data, you look at labor force participation, if you go all the ripples can through COVID for many reasons, health, finance, what happened to the economy. We saw labor force participation drop by 2 million people in the 55 plus, which is just a massive number of, quote, retirees as they left the labor force. And then now in the last year and a half or so, they've 1.5 million of them come back. Technically, and not all 2 million retired, and not, but what is amazing to me is that we've got all these people kind of coming back a little bit to work. And I wanted to ask you about this because I know you talk about how if you're 60 plus, there hasn't been enough conversation around what are you going to be doing for 20, 30, 40 years. So have you talked much about this unretirement trend?
Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head, Wes. But there's three converging forces, I think, that are bringing it all about. First of all, people are starting to scratch their head and say, having time off is great and getting a break from work is great. And maybe I'd like to even do something different, but I don't know that I want to kind of now work for 30 or 40 years. Last 10 years, the average American retiree, and we got about 70 million retirees, watched 47 hours of television a week. And that's like a bad joke. The second thing that's happening is that the generation of people who are currently retiring have not done a terrific job of preparing financially. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of people scratching their head and saying, I don't think I can afford this. Maybe I ought to work a few more years. And the third force is we have low unemployment. You know, if there was high unemployment, for example, when Social Security was crafted, the unemployment level was 25%. So part of the purpose of that program was brilliantly conceived, was to give a little bit of a stipend to people so they wouldn't wind up in the poorhouse. It was $120 a year to start, but it was also to get the old people out of the workforce so that those young people could get started with their families and their jobs and, you know, get on with their lives. Today, we need workers. We need brain surgeons. We need engineers. We need FBI operators. We need all kinds of talent. And, you know, it's one thing if you're working in a retail store and it takes 2 weeks to train you up to do the job. But if you're going to do knee surgery, why would you want to push somebody out the door just because they had a birthday? So
right.
There's a need for more of these older people. Now, people aren't saying they want to work until they're 100. They're saying maybe another 5 or 6 years. And maybe I'd like to work 3 or 4 days a week. Mm-hmm. And employers are beginning to create more flex retirement or flex work so they can keep some of that talent. And also people can have a better balance between work and leisure. Because this is, you've written about in your books, people want to have some fun. They want to enjoy themselves. They, you know, they don't want to just labor all the time.
So I guess that brings me to this, which is you write about your latest book that I know you've just revised, Radical Curiosity. I wrote a whole chapter about curiosity. I think of it as curiosity killed the cat. Lack of curiosity killed the happy retiree. My question is about self-discovery. And how do we reinvent, rediscover? And I want to hear about your journey around that. Like, what are some of the most important discoveries that have been seminal moments for you and impacted your journey? And then how can you help our listeners really think that through so that they have a really full 60 plus period of time?
Yeah, first of all, like you said, curiosity killed the cat. Boy, there's a concept, curiosity. It's got a bad rap, you know? People talk about abundance and success and wealth, and we don't talk about curiosity anymore, because people who are curious are asking questions. They're learning things. They're interacting with younger generations. They are keeping their minds open. That curiosity also inhibits, you know, cognitive loss, makes you more interesting. It causes life to be fresh. And it also might lead you to new possibilities. So what I came to realize in my life is that curiosity is kind of essential if you want to live a exciting and dynamic and open-minded long life. I mean, you know, we've all seen older people. Maybe you've got a grumpy uncle, or you got a next door neighbor who's no fun to be around, and all they want to talk about is how things used to be better in the old days, and they don't care about anything new. They don't understand why Taylor Swift is so happening right now, and they don't understand why it's so amazing that the Stones are kind of putting out a new album after 18 years of not doing that. And so,
and by the way, Harrison Ford, I just saw the other day that he's in his 80s.
He's 81.
He's like in half of my favorite new shows.
Yeah, he's like in every, you know, he's Kevin Costner, Harrison Ford, and Helen Mirren are in like every TV show and movie there is right now. By the way, I'll tell you an interesting story about Harrison Ford, which I think is to the point of your program. I spoke at a conference where he was the other keynote speaker. This is right before COVID. And he's a climate activist. And at the end of his speech, he said, "We got to get all the young people of the world planting trees, save the planet." And he got a standing ovation. And I had a private meeting with him afterward. And I, first of all, I fawned over him. What a life you've had. You've done some cool roles. What a great thing, you know.
I love you, Han Solo.
Right. You know, I mean, think about being Harrison Ford. I said to him, "Are you aware of the fact that there's a billion people in the world right now over the age of 60, and nobody has tasked them with anything?"
What did he say?
He pulled back, like you just did, and he said, "A billion people over 60, and we haven't given them anything useful to do? Wow, I never thought of that," he said. And I said, "By the way, think of the kind of the metaphysical message. If you got 60 or 70-year-olds planting trees in whose shade they might never sit, it makes a statement about how the old care for the future. And we don't have enough of that. We don't have enough. I'm not saying that older people should be obligated to join the military or should be forced into service, but only 24% of today's retirees volunteer at all. And we know that volunteers are happier, healthier, have more fun, meet new people, feel good about their lives. By giving, they get. And we haven't really yet created a world, again, this is a new frontier, where older adults think, I can't wait to stop working so that I can spend a few hours a week at the church or the mosque or the synagogue or helping out at the schools. Or, for example, you're a financial pro. Think of all the inner city kids that could benefit if some financial professionals went into those schools and taught the basics of money management. You'd have people who for the rest of their life would be in better shape financially. You know, why wait until you're 55 to start thinking about money? We ought to be learning about it in high school.
Well, okay, so you essentially said, so Harrison Ford said, we got to get the youth planting trees. And you were like, hey, what about the billion 60-year-olds? Why should they be planting trees, right?
Yeah, and he was sort of dumbfounded by the idea. And he was in his mid-70s at the time, so you would have thought it would have occurred to him that people of his era, his generation, might be better off if they were doing something a little more useful. We just did a big study. And by the way, all of our studies can be found for free on our website. And our website is agewave.com. And we asked people, would they rather be youthful or useful? And it was 4-1. People said, useful is what I want to be when I get older. But I don't know how to do it. I don't know where to go. I don't know what's right for me. I don't want to spend 50 hours a week working. If I want to do a couple, 3 hours a week, how do I work that out? And you think with all these AI wizards out there, they could work out the right kind of protocols so that people could figure out what's the right match for them as they reach that stage of life.
Is your cash working for you? For years, banks have gotten away with paying next to nothing for the privilege of holding your money. Today, investors have more options as the Federal Reserve has raised and raised and raised interest rates dramatically. Why not take advantage of it? If you're interested in finding a higher yielding solution for the safety allocation of your investment portfolio, reach out to my team at yourwealth.com. That's Y-O-U-R wealth.com. All right, so what do you mean by the life's third age?
So this is not an idea that I made up. I actually put out 3 books during COVID. And by the way, all my earnings from those 3 books are being donated to not-for-profit organizations. It's partly my way of giving back. I like the idea of volunteering and working pro bono. And I try to do it by...
Ken must have done a lot of good retirement planning to be able to have all your proceeds go to the...
I did.
That's cool, yeah.
I did. You know, one of the good things about working with a lot of financial firms, you get to sit in the back of the room, and even though I usually never understood the words they were using, and I know you're anti-jargon also, I did get the idea that you have a lot more freedom to do and be and live how you want if you got your financial house in order. So that's kind of like right at the top of the list.
Yeah. Life's third age.
Yeah, it comes from the European traditions of lifelong education. But the belief is that throughout most of history, people lived only through their first age, which was the first approximately 30 years of life. Now, Wes, I'm going to tell you something. You're going to say that can't be true. Throughout 99% of human history, the average life expectancy worldwide was under 18.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners, if you're going back over world history,
100,000 years.
We're living at the 0.1% of a period of time when we actually can live beyond our 20s.
Right. So the first age was 0 to 30, and your focus is, you know, growing up, surviving deadly diseases, accidents, trauma, war. And then we began to have improvements in 18th, 19th, and 20th century in medicine and pharmacopoeia, public health, and people started living into their 40s and 50s. And so we created a second age, and all of a sudden society became kind of dominated by people in the second age of men and women. And now what we're seeing emerging is a third age, life after 60, which could also wind up being 30 years for people. And most of us are just clueless about what we could do and where we should live and should we have roommates and should we keep working and how much money are we going to need? And so it's sort of uncharted territory. Think of Lewis and Clark. It's for pioneers, and it's for people to, like you, begin folks thinking about, it's not just how much money am I going to have or need, but how am I going to spend it down? And then it's about who am I going to enjoy having time with? And it's about how am I going to keep my health span trying to match my lifespan? Because most people don't want to be sick for the last 10, 15 years. And last, it's about purpose. We've done work these last bunch of years, again, all free, the reports. We've done it with various financial firms and wonderful partners like Merrill and Edward Jones and Ameriprise and such. And what we've learned is that when people think of planning for their later years, it's not just about money. It's, well, how do I think about giving back? How do I think about getting more time with the people I like and making new friends and intergenerational connections? How do I get away from the family and friends that I think are toxic? Mm. Because that's not the way I want to spend my last decades. And also purpose. What can I do that would give me new purpose? A lot of us spend our years at jobs and in careers that some 19-year-old version of ourselves one night at a party thought it would be a fun thing to do for the rest of our life. And then we find ourselves at 55 or 60 thinking, I don't know, did I really want to be an accountant? Did I, you know, am I really cut out to be a chef? I mean, I cut out to be a homemaker. You start to get a little bit of emotional intelligence and you can really think about, what would I like to do now? And then how do you get yourself on that track?
Well, is that, you know, and I want to ask about health span and whether we, health span versus lifespan. I mean, we all want to.
Oh, you're not going to like what I have
to
say.
Let's just go right there. Let's hear this. Yeah.
See, you're a radically curious kind of guy, huh? So this is, think about this as sort of a slightly newish way to think about things now that we've got all this new longevity and so many of us are living past 60. Mm-hmm. We've got our lifespan. That's the number of years we live. And in the United States, it's actually gone a little bit backwards during COVID. So we average life expectancy is about 77. We are 40th in the world when it comes to how long we live. So there are 39 countries in the world that live longer than we do. But then there's what's called health span, which is how many years in your life are you living without disability and pain and suffering? And we only live about 66 years with a positive health span.
No, I wanted you to share that because that's a number that doesn't, you don't hear about that number very often.
No,
nobody ever talks
about
health
span. I've watched every presidential debate now for the last 20 years, and I cannot believe that the media doesn't bring this question up. Get a load of this. We are 60th in the world when it comes to health span. Now, keep in mind that we spend more money on health than any country in the world, yet we're 40th when it comes to lifespan. 39 countries live longer than we do. And I'm sorry, I said 60th. We're 68th when it comes to our health span. So there's 67 countries in the world that live healthier longer than we do. And that stinks.
Yeah.
It stinks for people. It stinks for families because it requires a lot of caregiving. People spend down their wealth. Cost the country an enormous amount of money to pay for all of this. We got to fix that if we're going to continue to have longevity.
It's actually frustrating. I almost get worked up about it. I get almost angry.
Well, we ought to get worked up about it. It's outrageous. And it's outrageous that our politicians don't focus on it. It's outrageous it doesn't come up in the political debates. It's outrageous it's not identified as a number one, two, or three major American challenge. And I'm worked up about it. It doesn't make me happy. I'm ashamed to have to say this.
I think about Butner, you know, you probably know Dan Butner, the Blue Zones guy. I've loved his work for a lot of years, but you know, he makes this great point that it, I immediately, when you say, hey, our health span 66, which is terrible, I immediately want to know why. Like, what's the answer? And I know there's no one answer. But I think about, and I don't know if it's, maybe it's Singapore, recently that just catapulted into the top 10. Centenarians, and what Dan has talked about is that it's what the government there has done over the last 50 years to make it a walkable city and make it so that people are eating healthier. It's almost like you have to be in the right lifestyle. You can't just figure it out. And I guess it's just our lifestyle in America, for one reason or another, we're so far away from having a good health span. What would you say that if you had to say one reason, what is it?
Well, I have to say that I am captivated by Buettner's examination. And for those of your listeners who've never heard of him, it's Buettner. And he's got a series, I think it's on Netflix now. It's a four-part series about how to live to 100. And he travels to the regions of the world that have the most centenarians. And there's three or four things that he's found. Number one, they move around a lot. They walk. They work in their garden. When he goes to his first Okinawa, the city that he studies, it's very steep. The second, people have their, what he calls in Okinawa, their ikiga. It's their group. It's their group of friends and family that all care for each other. Third, people don't think about checking out. You know, when you get older, you still have a role to play as a mentor, as a loving adult. You concern yourself with the well-being of young people in your community. Singapore, when I was in my 20s, I got asked to meet with Lee Kuan Yew, who was then the senior minister who kind of created modern Singapore. And he wanted to know in like a two-hour meeting, what's going to happen in the future as Singapore gets older and what should we do about it? And he went ahead and did everything.
Wait, so you were one of the guys that met with him?
Yeah.
Holy.
Long time ago.
That's amazing. I didn't see.
Well, what's more amazing is that he did something.
Yeah.
You know, he put in playgrounds for people of all ages in almost every community setting. He created walking streets so that people wouldn't be always in their car. He created essentially cash benefits if you live near your parents or your children.
What?
So there's just the things that we all could be doing to give us a longer health span and maybe even a longer lifespan that we in the United States, we don't eat healthy. You know, what Buettner found was if you take two cities, you put them that are right next to each other and sociologically they're identical. The only difference is in one city, it's got billboards for soft drinks and fast foods. Forget about whether there's even restaurants, just billboards. In the city that those don't exist, the body mass index is 15% lower. And what he's trying to do now is create blue zones in the United States. We just don't take it seriously. We think you get up, you keep your fingers crossed, and you're going to have money and have health and have fun. And it takes a little more individual and social intention to pull it off.
Yeah, it's almost like we're not set up for it. I mean, I've been a student of this. I think it was almost 20 years ago when his first Blue Zones came out. I remember I used to buy that as gifts for people 20 years ago. And Dan actually, you know, I've got him on the cover of this latest book, but it's almost like, meaning that I'm a student of it, I get it, and I also study. I think part of his work was inspiration for me to go reverse engineer the happy retiree. But we're not that set up for it is the problem. I mean, I know what to be doing, but I still don't walk, you know, to work. And I'm not moving all day. I mean, I'm jumping around in my chair when we're talking, but I'm not walking, you know, just accidentally 4 to 7 miles a day. And I'm not plant-based like I should be. And I even like to eat plant-based and I still don't do it. It's almost like we're just not as set up for it in the United States. And I don't know why, but maybe guys like you and guys like me will try to start to turn that tide.
Well, first I want to say that this is kind of new. We got to give ourselves a little bit of a break. That we never really before in history had to think about, do I want to live to 100? And if not, why not? And what are the people tell me that they don't want to live to 100 if they don't have their brain working or if they're in pain or if they're a burden on their family? So this is kind of new stuff. And as we talk about it on programs like yours, Wes, and in your books and in my books, maybe more and more people will start to say, hey, this is important. And then we got to be careful because every type of snake oil salesman you can imagine is now claiming to have the cure for aging.
Illness. Ken, we got it. We've got Ozempic, right? Ozempic. Now we can lower our weight. It's good for kidney disease now. It's good for cardiac. We can just eat French fries all day and take Ozempic and we're going to be fine.
Yeah, unfortunately, we Americans, it seems like things in pill form. So rather than do the work like what Buettner has reverse engineered, those cultures, these centenarians seem to live a certain way. We just rather take a pill. And, you know, shame on us. And we're getting what we pay for. You know, we're getting an unhealthy life where we're taking a lot of pills. And I think there needs to be a wake-up call. I think that this is a serious problem.
You know, I know that in some of your talks, you've talked about kind of the history of just medical innovation, you know, pharmacology or pharmaceuticals. And that's partially, of course, that's primarily why life expectancy has increased for the last century or so. But to some extent in the United States, well, I guess and maybe this is just more of a current event, is the hype around these, I guess they're what Ozempic would be, a semaglutide drug where it's can, you know, lower our weight, et cetera. It's not necessarily a bad thing because it may help with longevity, but do you think it just contributes to the, hey, we can still do whatever we want to do and just take another pill to make it go away?
Yeah. First of all, I'm not one who knocks the pharma industry all the time because a lot of people think if you knock the pharma industry, then you're on the right side of everything. And, you know, my dad lived to 93 and he was diabetic, and if it wasn't for his insulin shots, he never would have known my children. Yeah. So I'm grateful for the pharma industry. But it's a little bit like thinking that by using your credit card a lot, you're saving for retirement. You're not, you know, you're spending yourself into debt. And I also am old enough now to remember thalidomide, which was a drug that created deformed children. I don't think we know for sure about drugs like Ozempic. I think that it's all just like happened in the last couple of years that everybody's talking about it. But I think that some of these, as you and Buettner would say, more old-fashioned approaches, healthy diet. I haven't eaten meat for over 40 years. Regular exercise, playing a meaningful role in your life, you know, having purpose, having people you care about who can care about you. I think we ought to spend a little more time and attention on those non-pill approaches.
Non-pill approach. Ken, what about you've been married, I think, for what, probably almost how many years?
It'll be 40 years next month.
And you and your wife, Maddie, you all re-up your vows? Is that, you do it every year?
Yeah, you've done your homework, huh? So the night I married Maddie, we were both 33, and we were broke. We had no money, but we were in love.
Where did you meet Maddie?
Well, oddly, she had grown up in New Jersey also, but we met in California. She was an actress and working on a soap opera, and a mutual friend introduced us. But the night we got married, I said to her, this is really fun. We ought to do this every year. And she said, you know, people don't do that. And I said, well, they should. You know, they celebrate Halloween every year. They celebrate birthdays. We celebrate Mother's Day, Father's Day. Why not take a few minutes every year and remarry your partner? Or if you're not married, maybe just celebrate a friendship. And then Maddie said, okay, but if we're going to do that, let's get married in a different location with a different religion. So we've had 39 weddings so far. We got married at the Chapel of Love in Las Vegas. We got married. And by the way, we don't invite a lot of people. It's usually just whoever the minister is that's doing the service and a photographer. We got married at the Chapel of Love in Versailles, France. We got married at the top of the Chichen Itza pyramid. We got married at the Church of Spilt Blood in Russia, in St. Petersburg, Russia. We got married by a skiing judge of Vail in Vail, Colorado.
Skiing judge, meaning that
Yeah, you just tell him what slope you're going to be on, and he skis in with a photographer and a Bible, and he marries you, takes $100 and skis off.
What mountain is this again? Where is this?
Vail Mountain in Colorado. You'd be surprised. You could check into any hotel or go to any concierge and say, can you arrange a marriage for me? They can do it in a minute. And people actually have always enjoyed doing these services with us. We've had our kids marry us a couple of times because they feel like, what a nice thing. Usually couples are fighting or, you know, your relationship can get lost in the tangle of modern life. So people have always felt, what a nice thing. Here's a couple of people who want to stay together. And by the way, I'll tell you one other thing, Wes, that we do. When we have our weddings, and they're usually around Thanksgiving, we got married on Thanksgiving, we take some time to talk. You know, hey, how did last year go for you? How could I be a better partner? Where did I miss my marks? How can we have a better marriage going forward? What might next year look like? You know, you do that with your business. You do that with your school. You do that with your financial planner. Why not do that with your partner? And I'm not suggesting that all of your listeners do it, but I suggest you take at least a minute to think about it. It's not that hard to do. And it's helped us in it. You know, we got married in the years where each of our parents died. We got married when our kids were being born, and it served to kind of glue us together in some special ways.
Have you ever, I guess it's probably because you're getting a reset every year. I was going to ask, how is it? Have you had some difficult years though, even doing this, or has it kind of helped you?
Oh yeah. That was a surprise part of my memoir, Radical Curiosity, that you mentioned at the top of the show. You know, I'm a risk taker, so I've had some failures in business. We've had some years where we were fighting a lot, my wife and I. I've had some times where I wasn't sure which way I was pointed, you know, what I ought to be doing with my life. And at least to date, I've managed to sort all of those out and work them out with the help of my wife and me helping her too, as she's gone through difficult times. Losses and confusions and uncertainties. And I think we ought to take our lives a little more seriously. I think we think of them as just sort of unfolding and everything works out. And I don't know who got that idea.
As you've grown older, how has your purpose changed? How has that evolved for you?
Well, I watch my kids who are 33 and 36, and their purpose is appropriate for that stage of life. You know, they want to have a lot of fun. They're in love. They're thinking about trying to make their job a little better. They look at the world, and it seems like it's lost its mind. As I've grown older, I like to think I've got a little more resilience. Every now and then I listen to myself reasoning through things and I think I've gotten a little smarter. Maybe even a little wisdom is popping up here and there. I try to steer clear of people and things that I think are not worth my time. I've learned from a lot of the older people I've worked with that you don't want to go through your life only to later on have regrets. I should have done that, or why did I waste so many years doing something I didn't care about? Which requires a willingness to make changes.
Have you ever gone too far risk-wise? Do you ever regret it?
Work-wise?
Well, no, risk-wise, work-wise. Have you ever regretted taking too big of a leap?
Well, you're asking two questions. Looking back, I can see that there were a couple of times where I took some leaps that were beyond. For example, I started 6 companies in the 1990s and raised a lot of capital. Mm-hmm. Not anticipating that the internet would come along and make it very hard, if not impossible, to raise more capital for a publishing company, a food company, a health store, an intellectual property company that focused on the aging brain. So yeah, I I went too far and lost it all. Do I regret it? Not really. I kind of feel like life's got its moments for risk. And I don't want to be a guy in my final hours that says, oh, I didn't take risks, or I didn't try new things, or I didn't see how far I could swing the bat, you know?
What lesson would you have every politician learn right now? Every educator, every healthcare provider, every financial advisor, when it comes to aging or rediscovery or radical curiosity?
I think all of our politicians need a new framework for thinking about longevity. Number one, what do we do with all these older people? To cast them aside as worthless is just plain stupid. Number two, how are we going to pay for it? And it's called the third rail of politics, that if you bring up the idea of tinkering with any of the safety nets that older adults receive and the age at which they receive them, you'll be voted out of office. But there's doing the moral thing, doing the right thing, which is to have these discussions and bring them forward. And last, I think we need to re-mastermind our healthcare system to create health, which we're not doing, and everybody's avoiding it. And it's not a matter of giving everybody access to an ineffective healthcare system. It's creating a healthcare system that produces healthy, long-lived, productive, happy, pain-free men and women.
Yeah, I think it is part of this. You're right. It's so third rail, and because politicians, can be in the House they can be in the House of Representatives for 40 plus years. You know, they're much more worried about getting reelected than tackling problems, and that again, I don't even know. I guess that is a political debate, but.
Yeah, I'm getting asked that a lot lately, and I usually don't weigh in on it, but I don't know if it's about age. You know, I think it's pretty cool that Nancy Pelosi is running for office again at 83. Yeah. And I think in some ways that people in their 80s who are trying to have a voice in politics, they're pioneers. Mm-hmm. There'll be more such people in the future, maybe 90-year-olds. However, I think we miss out on the life stage that younger people are in if we're creating a gerontocracy. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it like to be dreaming of the future? What is it like to be worried about the climate? What is it like to wish that we had more peace and less violence? Kinds of things that younger people are clamoring for. And I think we'd be better off if we didn't have our own version of age apartheid, where older people had more power and younger people were on the sidelines. I think if we had all the generations weighing in from their station in life, we'd have a wiser America.
Yeah, no, well, my point to clarify on that is not so much about the age of politicians, it's the fact that they can be in the same job and be a representative for 40 plus years and they don't want to. So it's really a question about term limits, which makes it so that politicians in general don't take on longer term projects that are even slightly unpopular in the early onset, because it's not good for reelection, right? And I think that that's part of, you know, look, if you think about setting up a city for longevity, it takes like 30, 40, 50 years. Right, to make a social network or social service program work, it's a generational item when elections are every 24 months. It's like that. It's hard to square the two sometimes. I wanted to ask you as we start to wrap up here, your thoughts around legacy. Have you always thought about legacy? Are you thinking about it more now? That your kids are full-blown adults and they're creating their own families now. And what is your advice around thinking about legacy or maybe how you think about it personally?
Well, sometimes the work we do at AgeWave overlaps with my own personal curiosities, right around the time my dad was passing away, we did a big study on inheritance. And in the focus groups, nobody wanted to talk about inheritance. So I whispered into the focus group moderator, ask about legacy. Would you like to leave a legacy or receive one? And everybody did. And then we found that there were four dimensions of legacy. You know, your wealth and real estate, and possessions that had some emotional value, you know, dad's baseball glove or the house by the lake, instructions and wishes to be fulfilled. But number one were values and life lessons. And then I started, you know, hunting around, as you do, and I realized that in many of the religious traditions, there was two wills, a material will, the stuff I own and who gets what, and then what was either called an ethical will or a spiritual will. And it was, what are the lessons you've learned in your life? And you don't need to be famous or have met with powerful people, but you probably learned a few things along the way. And if, you know, I were going on a camping trip and a bunch of people were coming back from having traveled the same territory where I'm heading, might be a good idea to ask them, are there any rattlesnakes up ahead? Where's the fresh water? Is there a place to catch the sunset? And I don't have to take any of their lessons, but I might benefit from hearing them. So I decided that I would, my legacy would be my stories and my life lessons. And that's what's in Radical Curiosity. And all my other books, I've done 19 now, have been about a phenomenon, you know, about the workforce or healthy aging or financial preparedness. This one is kind of from the inside out. What have I learned through my failures? What have I learned by being a dad? What have I learned by trying to be a good husband? What have I learned by being a boss? What have I learned by having made some money? And I like to think that that's my legacy. And also that I've pounded away at this aging subject for just about 50 years, when lots of people have come and gone or jumped into it in the last couple of years because they thought it was kind of the hot new thing. But I've been on this beat a long time.
You know, I want to ask you maybe our final question about what is next. So you have been, you're one of the originals when it comes to aging. I want to know, what do you think is next over the next 10 years in your field? But on, let me just ask you maybe a more fun / personal note. Besides work stuff, besides writing books, what are your core pursuits, hobbies on steroids, the fun things? If you weren't going to continue to work, and maybe, and I count that as a great core pursuit for those 60 plus, but what are some of the fun things you do?
Well, I'd have to say time with my wife and my kids and my new daughter-in-law. And I've got great friends in my company that I enjoy. And I work out every day, and I've had a yoga practice for 53 years, which I enjoy. But I will tell you in all honesty, I'm at a stage in my career where I'm beginning to wonder, should I work a little bit less and have some more time for play? And I'm not even sure how to do that because I've been such a productive workaholic for half a century. I should read your books.
And then again, what do you think's next with aging?
I think a few things. You want to hear the good, the bad, or the ugly?
Yeah, I like, let's do good, bad, ugly.
So on the good side, you know, the dream of history. For tens of thousands of years, we've dreamt of living long lives. And I think that billions of people are going to live long lives. And that's pretty incredible. Notwithstanding all the things we discussed about what are you going to do with your time and will you have enough money and so on and so forth. That's the good. The bad, I worry that older people won't relinquish power, that, you know, we'll become a gerontocracy, whether it's in politics or in family or in business, that older people will not let go and not make room for young ideas, young thinking, young energy, young vision, young priorities. In the ugly, there are diseases and illnesses like Alzheimer's, cancer, that stroke, that more likely happen to older people. And we have not focused our medical system on or our scientific community on eliminating these diseases. When I was 30, I collaborated on a book with Jonas Salk. And one night over dinner, Dr. Salk told me how in the 1940s, everybody thought we were going to need more iron lungs because poliomyelitis was rampant.
Wait, again, Salk is in the guy, the polio.
Right.
Salk and Sabin, right?
Jonas Salk and Sabin
came up
with a vaccine that pretty close to eliminating the disease. I think we need to spend the money to wipe out diseases like dementia and cancer rather than just keep them prolonged. I don't think anybody wants to be taken down by those ugly diseases. And so longevity has got its good and its bad and its ugly.
By the way, do you have a take on the any of the progress we have seen on that? I know it's super early with, I guess it's, we've got a couple, like Eli Lilly's had some breakthroughs. But all of that is just for dementia or Alzheimer's, just to slow the progression, but not really fix it. Have you looked at that at all?
Yeah, I was a marketing advisor to the Alzheimer's Association in 1990. So I've been on this beat a long time. Last year or two, there's been some progress. But there are medications that are very expensive. Question as to whether Medicare is willing to reimburse for them. And at best, they slow the progress among some people. Mm-hmm. I want a vaccine. I want a Salk vaccine. Boom. No more dementia. So that's my standard. There's progress and there's more attention and there's more scientific intelligence, but not nearly enough.
All right, last question. What's your favorite piece of advice for a would-be retiree or retirement?
Take a breath. A lot of people charge from their job to their retirement and want to be active. And I think this is going to sound really dopey, and I apologize. But when I was a young man, I thought, you know, being a wordsmith guy and a writer, I thought that the parts of the sentence that mattered the most were the nouns. And then I got a little more zen in my 30s, and I thought the verbs were what really mattered. You know, it's the being, not the thing. And then when I got a little older, I thought I was really getting sharp when I thought the adverbs, it's how you move and how you relate and how you do what you do. But as I've gotten older, I'm completely convinced it's the punctuation points. It's the time where you stop and tell your wife, I love you. It's the time you pause to think. It's the time you reflect on what's next. And they're awkward. Sometimes punctuation points are awkward. Even if I stop talking for a moment here on your program, that's a little awkward. But that's the advice I'd give. Take a deep breath.
It was just the battery.
Take a deep breath and also talk to try to find some role models. Mm-hmm. We have role models. If you're a kid and you want to be a basketball player or a football player, we have role models in science. We have role models in church. Yeah, we also don't have role models in later life. And I think that's valuable.
Well, you're one of mine, Ken.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all, this is Mallory with the Retire Sooner team. Please be sure to rate and subscribe to this podcast and share it with a friend. If you have any questions, you can find us at wesmoss.com. That's WESMOSS.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and YouTube. You'll find us under the handle Retire Sooner Podcast. And now for our show's disclosure. This information is provided to you as a resource for informational purposes only and is not to be viewed as investment advice or recommendations. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal. There is no guaranteed offer that investment return, yield, or performance will be achieved. Stock prices fluctuate, sometimes rapidly and dramatically, due to factors affecting individual companies, particular industries or sectors, or general market conditions. For stocks paying dividends, dividends are not guaranteed and can increase, decrease, or be eliminated without notice. Fixed income securities involve interest rate, credit, inflation, and reinvestment risks and possible loss of principal. As interest rates rise, the value of fixed income securities falls. Past performance is not indicative of future results when considering any investment vehicle. This information is being presented without consideration of the investment objectives, risk tolerance, or financial circumstances of any specific investor and might not be suitable for all investors. Investment decisions should not be based solely on information contained here. This information is not intended to and should not form a primary basis for any investment decision that you may make. Always consult your own legal, tax, or investment advisor before making any investment, tax, estate, or financial planning considerations or decisions. The information contained here is strictly an opinion, and it is not known whether the strategies will be successful. The views and opinions expressed are for educational purposes only as of the date of production and may change without notice at any time based on numerous factors such as market and other conditions.